Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. In this episode, we're going to be talking about Elon Musk. Now, Elon Musk, I know, is a somewhat controversial character. A lot of people have divergent views on him. I've got to admit, I quite like the guy. He's made me a lot of money, so I like that. I'll tell you the story on that. But Elon Musk is an interesting character. He's had 10 children by three different women. He started six billion-dollar businesses. It's a little bit difficult to value the Boring Company and Neuralink, which we're coming to talk about. But at very minimum, there's four times he started a billion-dollar company, which is hugely impressive. It's seven if you count OpenAI, which he was a founder of. And actually, he's just started another company, XAI, which will very likely be number eight. So this is a truly stellar business success record. I think it is one which is often overstood. A lot of people, when I talk to them about Elon Musk, they say things to me like it's all subsidies or something like that. It's not really. There is an element of that that came in the beginning. But nevertheless, there is a remarkable character there, and it's worth just taking a look at his story and some of the interesting things that he's done along the way. And actually what prompted me to do this now was there's been a lot of chatter in these last few weeks about his rebrand of Twitter going to x.com. I think there was a lot more to that than the surface level analysis is suggesting. A lot of people are talking about that as in, oh, Musk has done something stupid because he's diluting the value of the brand and all that kind of stuff. No, actually, I think there is far, far more going on there. But we come to that at the end when we talk about Twitter, which is one of his latter companies. And the story about how I made money from Twitter. Not from Twitter, from Elon. So basically, it was 2019, and I'd left the city at that point, and I was sort of, because my work had always led me to be UK focused, because that was our mandate, I was only then just starting to look at the broader macro environment. I was starting to build my macro thesis, which ended up being very much focused around liquidity flows. And that largely came out of the US, the large amount of liquidity that was coming out of the US. And that then pushed me to start looking at things that would respond well to liquidity, which was crypto, long duration tech. What I mean by long duration tech, I mean technology companies where the flow of future profits and cash was going to be pushed out into the future, and therefore that would benefit from a cheap value of time expressed through the interest rate and would respond very well to an injection of liquidity, which would have been, you know, quantitative easing. Now it turned out I was right on that, because of course that was 2019 I was building this macro thesis, and then 2020, as we know, there was a massive injection of liquidity. So I was looking in the right area. So I had started to take a look at NASDAQ, which was a change for me, like I said, because I'd always been UK-focused before that. And what made me take a look at Tesla in particular and Elon Musk is because I'm also very plugged into the political side of thing on our kind of sphere. And I was watching a Steven Crowder skit on Elon, where they were sort of making fun of him. And I thought, well, this is kind of interesting, because I was seeing him bashed at the time all over the place by the left and the right. And that's quite unusual. You don't normally see individuals getting attacked by people on the left and the right at the same time. That's kind of odd, that everything seems to tribalise on this. But for whatever reason, he was. So then I thought, okay, well, let's see what's going on here. Let's take a look at Tesla. And at first glance, a very superficial level analysis, it looked kind of absurd, because here's this car company which is producing fewer cars than, say, Honda, but was valued almost as much as them. And so it looked on first blush to be particularly overvalued. And my first reaction was, okay, well, this is a shorting opportunity. I can go short this stock. But I have a discipline where if I'm going to make an investment, I want to understand the counter argument as well as the pro argument. I want to make sure both arguments are clear in my mind so that I made sure I haven't missed anything. And when I started to seriously focus on the positives of Tesla, I'd started to realise that actually the narrative was just wrong, and that my first reaction was completely wrong, that this was an absolute monster of a company coming down the track, and its future earnings would be huge. And I kept on looking at this, and I mean, I was spending every waking hour on this. I mean, I was waking up in the morning, looking at this until like midnight, and just repeating that day after day. I mean, what was I doing? I mean, I was reading all the financial data I could get on it, any analyst reports I could get, which was a lot less now that I was out of the professional world, because I couldn't get access to a lot of stuff. But you can still kind of access a lot of interesting reports. I was building my own financial models of Tesla, and I was watching loads and loads of interviews of Elon, because, you know, that's a great thing to do whenever you're looking at a company, is to watch interviews with the CEO to get a measure of the man. And I was looking at this more and more, and I was thinking, okay, everybody hates this stock. It was, even back then, it was one of the most shorted stocks. I mean, it has now been the most shorted stock in all of history. But a lot of people were shorting this. Reaction was negative. Most analysts were incredibly negative. Most investment houses were negative. And I kept on looking at this thinking, why is what I'm seeing so different to the vast majority of people out there? And eventually got to the point where I just thought, nope, everybody else is wrong and I'm right. And I didn't just make an allocation. I went all in on it. I decided, yeah, this is the thing. And I started buying at $12 a share, split adjusted. I think it was like $197 at the time, but there's been some stock splits along the way. So I started buying at $12 a share, and I didn't finish buying until it was much higher than that. But it's now at close to $300 a share. So that was nice. And it's gives you a sort of a rosy perspective on the chap. From that perspective. So anyway, so I followed it quite close, because even though I've dialed down the allocation now to go into various other things, basically Bitcoin and gold and a few other things as well, I have watched this one very closely, because for a long time, and it continues to be a large part of the portfolio allocation. So I keep a very close eye on what happens on it. I'm not quite as deep into it as I used to be. I mean, it used to be literally the case where they couldn't build a new wall in one of the factories without me knowing about it. I was that deep into, the real minutiae of the news flow when it was, well, basically, you know, an investment for me, you know, bigger than the house. So it deserves a lot of focus and a lot of attention. So I think I've come to know this guy reasonably well. There was a time when I could watch him give an interview on one of his companies, and you know, I could pretty much pause the video and give the answer that he was going to give, and it was, you know, pretty accurate. So I think I got inside his head. And I do think he's an interesting character, and it's worth talking about. So this is going to be an episode basically just running through the history of him and the companies and my observation on the business logic as he went through his business and career, you know, ventures, as it were. Right. So let's start off. He was born in 1971. So he's a Gen Xer, sort of middle stage Gen Xer. So he was born in 1971 in South Africa. As far as I can tell, his dad did not own an emerald mine. That is something that you often hear. I think his father might have had shares in an emerald mine, but that's about as far as it goes. He didn't own a mineral or own 50% of it or anything like that, which is one of the common things you hear. What I do know is that he had a very bad relationship with his father. he did actually live with him because his parents separated. And then Elon felt sorry for his father because his father was living alone. So Elon volunteered to go and live with him for a while. And I don't know the details of it, but I know that he was frequently left alone. And his only companion was books. So he did a hell of a lot of reading, and he's an inquisitive, intelligent guy, so he did a hell of a lot of reading. And the other thing he does say, that even though he does have a very bad relationship with his father, his father was an electrical engineer. And his father, when he did interact with him, would teach him about principles of physics and electrical engineering, which obviously put Elon in quite good stead for the companies that he built thereafter. Musk developed an early interest in computing, and he taught himself video programming. And actually, at the age of just 12, he wrote a video game in BASIC, and it was called Blaster. And he sold that to a PC and office technology magazine, I think it was, for about $500. And this was back in 1983 when he was just 12 years old. He went to the Pretoria Boys School in South Africa. He survived a vicious beating from a demographic in South Africa that attacked him one day and beat him almost to death for absolutely no reason. It was just, you know, they just saw a white boy walking alone and they decided to attack him and beat him very heavily. But, you know, he was fortunate that he was able to come back from that. He describes a fairly lonely period, and we talked about his reading. He did read a lot of sci-fi. He's a big fan of the Foundation series and the Culture series. In fact, he often names his starships that he has now on ship names from the Culture series. What he did describe is that he had a bit of an existential crisis. This is something that is common to young men. You know, films like Taxi Driver, you know, will show you that dynamic, and I'm sure any young men watching will know there is a period you tend to go through early in life, which is like, you know, what is your focus? What is the point of this? You know, what are you doing? And he says that he found the answer to that question himself by reading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which, if you haven't read it, it's a fun sci-fi book. It's basically describing how the Earth is actually a supercomputer that had been working on solving the answer to the meaning of life, the universe, and everything for billions of years. Anyway, when it finally spits out the answer, the answer is 42. At which point, they then realise that they haven't done the preliminary step of working out what the question you're supposed to ask is. And as Musk observes, this is actually a philosophy book disguised as a sci-fi book. And what it is essentially saying is that you need to figure out what your question is, what your purpose in life is. And so he then started thinking about it. Okay, what's my purpose in life? What do I want to do? And he decided that the answer had to be, and again, probably referenced by his love of sci-fi, was his mission in life was to make life multi-planetary, which, you know, is a fairly lofty goal. This is a bit like young boys deciding they want to be an astronaut and all that kind of stuff. But in this particular case, he was Elon Musk, so he managed to make a good go of it. And so there, here we go. That's his life goal now set: make life interplanetary. So anyway, after high school, Musk then moved to Canada. He studied there. He did that because he didn't want to go into mandatory military service in South Africa. So he left and he went to California. He stayed there for a while and he did some qualifications. And then he went over to the US. I think he started initially as an illegal immigrant, but he managed to get his papers in order eventually. He then earned two bachelor's degrees from the University of Pennsylvania, one in physics and one in economics. The economics one was from the Wharton Business School. And then Musk moved to California in 2002, where he then attended Stanford University. He didn't finish it because he decided to pursue a career in business instead. And his first business was something called Zip2. And this was back in 1996. And he did that with his brother, Kimball, Zip2 was a city guide software company that provided things like business directories, maps, directions, all that kind of stuff. So basically, it was a proto version of Google Maps, effectively. That was the first company that you could say, you know, I want to go from here to here, and it would, you know, plot you out a route and do that kind of stuff. So this was it's something that we're used to now, but that was revolutionary at the time. But essentially, there was nothing that different about this particular company, because, of course, what he's thinking about there is basically taking the analog world and recreating it in a digital setting. So this is, at the moment, we have directories, we have these like yellow, well, back then we have these yellow pages type things and these phone books and all the rest of it. And he was basically just taking that and creating a digital version. We had maps and he was creating a digital version of that. And then he was starting to add functionality on the back of that. Nothing especially remarkable in this first one, but he was one of the very first to do it. And so he managed to then sell that for quite a bit of money later on. I think it eventually, what did it sell for? It was something like $300 million, I think the business was sold for. It won various contracts along the way. It won contracts from the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune. It did a deal with Google. And so, you know, a lot of that tech got transferred across to there. So doing many things, and it was eventually sold. And okay, in 1999, so was that 3 years after he started the company? Yeah, it was $300 million, and he sold it to Compaq. Which was nice. And he used the proceeds of that to do a couple of things. One of the first things he did was buy a McLaren F1. You know, the really sexy cars that were all the rage back then. And on his initial drive of this McLaren F1, and these things cost like half a million each. On his first drive of it, he managed to crash it. And when his brother came to pick him up, he found him laughing uproariously by the side of the road. And he said to him, you know, why are you laughing? You've just crashed a McLaren F1. And he said, no, that's not the funny thing. The funny thing is it wasn't insured. So glad he could see the humour in it. And I guess if you just had a $300 million payday, that helps. What he also did is from that, he then created something called X.com, which, of course, we've heard about more recently because he's rebranded Twitter to that. And it was an online payment company which would later become PayPal and then become something else. So we come back to that. We come back to PayPal. But at this point, we have to introduce wife number one. Now, wife number one was Justine Wilson. She was a Canadian. They met at university. They had six sons together. So unfortunately, tragically, the first son died in 2002. But they then went on to have another five sons. And it turns out that in the Musk line, there seems to be a lot of sort of twins going on. So first thing he had was Griffin and Xavier, a couple of twins in 2004. And then he had triplets, Damien, Saxon and Kai, in 2006. And then for whatever reason, not relevant here, he then divorced Justine in 2008. So that's wife number one and the first, six sons, five of which are surviving. Okay, so he's now created X.com with the money that he got out of Zip2. Now, what I find so interesting about that is the logic that he used in order to go for a payment company next. Because I told you in the first company, he's essentially just recreating the analog world in a digital format. And even though he was the first to do it, that by itself was not especially remarkable. What the vision for X.com was and why he decided that I need to make a payment company was not how you and I might have a business idea. Because what we might do is we say, okay, I'd like to start a business. What do I know about? You know, where's my skill set? Where does it lend me? Oh, this thing. I think I can make a business out of this. No, his logic was, okay, so we've got the internet, which is a thing, which is growing at a rapid rate. At the time, it was the fastest technology growth rate of any technology that had ever been around. So we could see that this thing was rising. So he wanted to do. So he knew he had to do something in internet, and he was originally looking at things which are more content based. But because the bandwidth was so low, if you remember back to the early 2000s, you know, even internet radio was stuttery. Video was nowhere near. Images were very, very difficult to do because of that extremely constrained bandwidth. So his logic was, okay, what is something which requires minimal possible bandwidth but has maximum possible value in the internet world, which is like a rising tide that will carry all boats? You know, what do I make out of this? And that logic led him to say, okay, well, it needs to be a payment company. It needs to be electronic money, essentially, which led to the logic of X.com, which became PayPal. It's interesting, the other characters, because he already had this idea. And then he started meeting some other people. One of the people he met was a guy called Peter Thiel. Now, those two met at an Ayn Rand conference. I'm sure you know Ayn Rand, but for those of you who don't, she was a very based, one of our people, author of an earlier era who, I won't get too much into her philosophy, but she was, she's on the right economically, very sensible. People who like Brokenomics would like Ayn Rand if they don't already know her, which I'm sure most of you do. So he meets Peter Thiel at an Ayn Rand conference. Now, you don't go to an Ayn Rand conference unless you are one of us, basically. So he meets Peter Thiel there. And Peter Thiel is super based. If you ever listen to him talk, especially some of his earlier interviews, I mean, he is again very much one of our people. He has gone on to create companies that are suspicious, which I will talk about in time. But Peter Thiel absolutely gets the Brokenomics thesis. He gets the Fed. He gets fiat money. He gets all of that stuff, and he talks eloquently about it. And what they initially set out to do, and this is not coming from Elon, but this is coming from Peter Thiel after they've come together, is he describes that they needed to create a parallel financial system that could sit outside of this broken one, which is broken for all of the reasons that we've talked about here on Brokenomics. And this all comes from a 1999 talk that you can look up, where he goes into some of the background of his ideology. It was a few years later that they then went on to create PayPal together, but you can see how his logic was evolving. And there needs to be a payment system that sits out of this. Now, they didn't actually end up achieving that. And actually, what he was describing is basically Bitcoin, although Bitcoin didn't exist at the time, but the logic that he was going through leads you to Bitcoin. But they were trying to do originally Bitcoin, but without solving the Byzantine generals problem, which is how can you, which is what blockchains and Bitcoin does, which is how can you have digital scarcity. So they were trying to do a alternative payment rail that lived inside the existing structure. So without the breakthrough that was Bitcoin, it was the right idea. It was the right focus. But it could never be delivered through to its logical conclusion, what they wanted to get out of it. So let's build into this. So after Zip2, he creates X.com, and X.com was, well, basically it was the first or maybe one of the first, but it was very early on, one of the first online banks. It was an FDIC insured. I mean, it's got its bank charter. It's got all of that stuff. So X.com was a proper bank. And a year later, so X.com then acquired Coinfinity, which was a software company that did money transfers. And the money transfer bit of that was called PayPal, right? And the PayPal service, you know PayPal, but it basically allows users to send money to each other via, you know, Palm Pilots or emails or whatever it is. And then a year after that, I think they started to understand the traction they were getting with this. And this is typical in young businesses. You set out with a brand, an identity, and a mission, and then basically you see where you're getting traction, and you pivot – I mean, so many companies like this, what they actually end up focusing is not what the original focus of the business was, because you have to be responsive to what's getting traction. And obviously what they found is what was getting traction was this PayPal bit within it. And so they basically threw the weight behind that. So one more year later, so 2001, they then changed the name of X.com to PayPal. But he obviously likes the name X.com, and you know, we talk about how that has recently made a comeback. So anyway, so that was growing like stink. I mean, it was absolutely taking off. So they did the right thing to pivoting to this brand. Another year later, so 2002. PayPal had its initial public offering, so basically the initial investors and, you know, Musk and Thiel would have raised money or possibly sold some of their existing shares to the stock market, essentially, so that PayPal became a listed company. And you know what they did is they basically revolutionized online payments. So before PayPal, sending money online was, I mean, it was really complicated back then. And it became very easy for individuals, businesses to send and receive money online with basically just an email address. Now, PayPal today, I mean, it's a major online payment process. I mean, it is dominant. I mean, it really is. It has millions of users, a whole bunch of services. I mean, the online payments things, but also money transfers and credit and all that kind of stuff. The PayPal of today has most definitely lost its way. So it wasn't that long ago. What was it? It was last year. It was October last year. They came out and they said that they were going to fine you $2,500 if you expressed anywhere on the internet an opinion that they didn't like. Misinformation, I think they called it. But, you know, that's basically just an opinion that they don't like. There was then a massive backlash against that. And they said, oh, no, sorry, we've made a mistake. We never intended to do it. They waited for the backlash to die down, and then by the end of the month, so it was all, I mean, this was whole thing was wrapped up in a month. Within a month, they basically bought it back again, and it was quietly reinstated. So I have closed down my PayPal account. I won't go anywhere near that again. So that the company today is pretty bloody awful. But luckily for Musk and Thiel, well, I mean, they got out 20 years ago, so they sold it to eBay in 2002. Musk owned a little under 12% of it at the time, and what did they sell it for? 1.5 billion they sold it for. So Musk walked away with 165 million from the sale of that, you know, which was nice bigger payday. Actually, it's also worth talking about not just Musk, his story with that, but what we now call the PayPal Mafia. Because there was a whole bunch of interesting characters who came out of PayPal. And this is often the case with one of these companies that gets acquired, and the original founders get a huge payday, especially if they're young, because invariably what these people then do is they then go off and they start another business. I mean, this was Musk's second business, having come out of Zip2. But there was a whole bunch of other people that are worth talking about. So Peter Thiel, that we've already mentioned, I mean, he's done loads of things. I mean, he's got loads of seed money investments, venture capital, all that kind of stuff. So he's active in a whole bunch of things. I mean, he was active. He was an investor, and he was active in Facebook. I mean, he was on the board until relatively recently. He founded Palantir Technologies, which is the thing that I alluded to, which is interesting because Palantir is basically is a software company that does big data analytics. And most of its clients are governments, basically. So it's used, I mean, if you look at the website, it's used in things like counterterrorism, fraud detection in elections, and a whole bunch of stuff. But it's very easy to look at that and its connections to the security agencies and wonder what's going on here, because if you listen to young Peter Thiel, he is absolutely our guy. He's super based. He gets all of this stuff. And actually, if you listen to him at you know, Bitcoin conferences today, again, he's, you know, super based, our guy kind of thing. But here he is running a company which is very intelligence agency adjacent, and all its big clients are businesses. So, I mean, Palantir is basically like the eye of Sauron. So, you know, what's going on there? I guess I need to research it more or try and figure out what's going on because, you know, that is an interesting paradox. If you are going to have somebody running the Eye of Sauron, I'd want it to be Peter Thiel. But all the same, what happened? Did he pivot? Is he still? I don't know. I don't know what's going on there. But anyway, interesting character. If we can get to the bottom of what he's doing there at Palantir, whole bunch of other people came out of PayPal as well. So Reid Hoffman. He founded LinkedIn, another big business that came out. There was a guy called Max Levchin, and he went off and he founded Slide. Which was then sold to Google. He then teamed up with another couple of guys to create Yelp. Those guys that did Yelp, that was Jeremy and Russell something. They went on to found Yelp, which is obviously a big business. David Sacks. Sacks is an interesting character. I like Sacks. So David is... He then effectively became an investor after this, a venture capitalist. He founded, he also founded Genie.com and Yammer, which is, you know, which are viable businesses in themselves, but he's been involved in a whole bunch of different businesses and startups that came out of Silicon Valley. And also he's very sensible on politics. He's worth following on Twitter, definitely, because his analysis of the US, Russia, Ukraine situation. He's also active in politics in giving stages to people like Ron DeSantis and more recently Vivek Ramaswamy. So he's essentially become a bit of a, you know, fundraiser, kingmaker to Republican politics, and you know, very sensible when you listen to him. There was a guy called something Botha. Ralph Bofa, something like that, and he went off to Sequoia Capital, where he basically then funded Instagram and Tumblr and Square, so interesting businesses. And the other big one that came out of it was there was three guys: Stephen Chen, Chad Hurley, and Jared Karim, right? And they went off and they founded YouTube, which then obviously got sold to Google. So that whole PayPal mafia, the capital that came out of that, you know, spawned some remarkable companies in itself.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest. Life comes at you fast, which is why it's important to find some time to relax. A little you time. Enter Chumba Casino. With no download required, you can jump on anytime, anywhere for the chance to redeem some serious prizes. So treat yourself with Chumba Casino and play over 100 online casino-style games, all for free. Go to ChumbaCasino.com to collect your free welcome bonus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21+. Terms and conditions apply.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.